Okay. First, I want to start off with a few acknowledgments before I dive in. I want to acknowledge and thank the Tischlers for all of the support you guys have given us over the last 7 years, especially early on into our marriage. It's been very instrumental, and I really love you guys. Second acknowledgement is to my small group. You guys are awesome. We dove in pretty deep yesterday, and Andy, I'm glad that you are leading the group, and I've felt this way before, but this was definitely a divine intervention in the group that we were in this year, so just wanted to acknowledge our group and the encouragement you guys have given me over the last 48 hours, and the last acknowledgement is I want to acknowledge the men in this room for what you guys are doing in this movement. It's extremely impactful, and it is going to impact generations, and it's impacted my marriage, my home, and I know it's going to impact our legacy, so I just want to acknowledge the work that's being done in this movement with the men in this room. Okay, y'all ready? Question is, am I ready? Okay. I grew up a preacher's kid in Houston, Texas. My mother was a teacher, my father a Protestant minister who worked 60-plus hours a week. Growing up as a preacher's kid came with a lot of pressures, much of which instilled a belief that I needed to be perfect. Any sign of blemish would reflect on my parents, more so on my dad. It was one thing as a child having to just be polite, dress conservatively, which I did not abide by as a teenager, and always smile, like a freaking Mary Kay beauty consultant. Being a preacher's kid didn't mean that I was always close to God and the Bible was always open in our home. That wasn't my reality. When my dad was home, he was just dad. I knew enough about Jesus to get confirmed and baptized at 12 and take communion like my mom, but I didn't know Jesus. He was like an imaginary friend who I could always have an inner dialogue with, and then that image of an imaginary friend became more like Santa Claus or a grandparent who never tells you no and gives you everything you want. When I think of my childhood, especially as a teenager, I couldn't wait to get out of the house and not be forced to go to church every Sunday. In my house, if you weren't dying of a fever or suffering from a plague, you were going to church. And youth groups was not an option either. I didn't fit in with the youth group kids because they didn't fit in with me. I was in the popular crowd and couldn't be bothered to be seen with them at school. I didn't know if it was the forced attendance or all the Jesus talk that burned me out on church. I specifically remember my reactions when my mom would quote scripture at me anytime some mean girl did something or when I was going through a breakup or a hard time. Every time she would quote Philippians or Romans to me, I would get so annoyed and tell her to stop spitting scripture at me because it wasn't helping my situation, and I didn't want to hear it. The last church my dad served was the worst of them all. My family was scrutinized, and the rumor mill ran rampant with false stories about me and my mom. Our last Sunday at that church was lukewarm at best, and we left with what was left of our dignity as a family. After that, I didn't trust the church or feel as though it was a safe place that they advertised. Christians became the same threat to me as the mean girls in school were. I grew resentful of God that he would have our family thrown to the wolves when my dad dedicated his life to his church. What kind of reward was that? Growing up, music was a big part of our life. My parents were both extremely musical. They met at TCU, and once my dad found out my mom was from Denver, he serenaded her with John Denver songs on his 12th string. My sister and I were both born with musical abilities and were taught at a very young age those were gifts that needed to be shared as a contribution to church and to take care of our craft by practicing every day. When I was 12 years old at a church camp much like this, I had a feeling that my musical talents God gave me meant I was destined for fame. In my head, I had a right to sing anywhere because you never knew when a record exec would be in the audience. I would learn much later that was not what that meant. I was a stubborn and extremely competitive person who strove for perfection. Failure did not happen to me until it did. Having had this idea needed to be perfect, that also meant my execution needed to be perfect. I had a false sense that bad things wouldn't happen to me. If I set my sights on something, I worked for it and I achieved it. Hearing that I couldn't do something made me want to do it even more. I loved a good challenge. I graduated high school and would go on to college. My mom, however, didn't want me to give up music and encouraged me to audition for American Idol. So off we went, in line for 6 hours. Then my moment arrived. I killed it, or so I thought. I was cut off after 15 seconds, and that was that. As we walked to the parking lot, my whole world was altered, and I felt like I had lost my identity. Up until then, most everything in life came super easy to me. I won first or second place in everything I did, and I put 1,000% effort into it. This absolutely crushed me, and I stopped singing, especially in public, for years. I was convinced my parents had lied to me about how gifted I was. Why would my parents do that? Is that just what parents say to their kids? Clearly, I needed to find a different path in life. This pursuit of fame and being discovered was a fool's errand, so time to grow up. College is a bit of a blur to me. I spent my first 2 years in College Station. I was determined to be a fighting Texas Aggie. In CS, you were either part of the Northgate crew or the Bible Thumpers, and I straddled the line of both. I lived in an off-campus dorm and went potluck with 3 roommates. These girls were beautiful, and one of them was a homeschooled Christian girl who was saving herself for marriage. This was foreign to me, and I thought this girl was off her rocker. The other 2 roommates were normal. I was so desperate for approval, I tried to be just like them. These girls wore cardigans and pearls and went to the Baptist church every Sunday, so I went with them, Bible in tow. I still didn't trust the church, but this time I could be anonymous. So I showed up, listened to sermons that made zero sense to me, and went back to my normal college life of promiscuity and parties. Junior year, I transferred to Sam Houston and rushed a sorority, forcing me to buckle up my academics, but throwing me further into promiscuity and parties. A few years after college, I decided it was time to spread my wings and get out of Houston, so I set my sights on Austin, Texas. This was the place I was going to marry a great guy, drive a black SUV, pop out a few kids, and live in a place with a great view. Not long after I moved to Austin, I met a guy at a gym and married him 14 months later. The night we got engaged, about 8 weeks after we met, I was in shock. While I remember spritzes of details, the thing I most remember that night is going to dinner with our families to celebrate, and my eyes were fixated on the TV watching Johnny Manziel win the Heisman Trophy. Yes, I was excited, I think, to be engaged. I loved his family, and clearly this guy loved me. The moment that ring went on my finger, it felt like a shackle, and my adoring boyfriend, who would have taken a bullet for me, turned into someone else weeks later. You think you have a feel for someone and how your life with them is going to go? Then there's a moment where it all changes. One night, after coming home from drinks with a friend, I said something that set him off. I blinked, and I'm being choke-held against my closet. Then I'm on the floor looking at glasses that were just on my face seconds earlier. I texted a friend asking if I could come to their house for that night, and her response was, "It's not as bad as it seems. You guys will figure things out." At that moment, I knew I didn't have a way out. I had doubts about marrying this man leading up to our wedding. Never did I think I would have a runaway bride moment, but I did. I was standing at the bottom of the stairs as my last bridesmaid was making her way to the altar. I was mapping out my escape in my head and knew there was a bathroom yards away with a window that would take me to my mom's car, and my parents would address our guests and fix it all for me. As I'm turning to go to the bathroom, one of my guests came out and gave me the biggest hug of congratulations. As I'm hugging him, I'm thinking, damn it, you're messing up my escape. Seconds later, my dad showed up, presented his arm to walk me down the aisle, and off we went. It was sunset, and we timed my ascent down the aisle perfectly. As I'm walking down the aisle to a Rich Mullins song my dad played obsessively when we were kids, I was literally blinded by the sun, and I couldn't see anything. I clung to my dad, and my thoughts were, he's just stressed at work, it's going to get better, he loves me, this is just a season. It really was an incredibly beautiful wedding and seemed like a fairy tale. The next day, we left for our honeymoon. Day 3, things turned, and all I wanted to do was come home and get things annulled. We made a mistake. It was about 8 or 9 months into our marriage that I first started having a suspicion he wasn't being faithful. Of course, his favorite hobby was gaslighting me into thinking I was crazy. About a year and a half into our marriage, my husband accepted a job offer and moved us to Minnesota. I was excited for this opportunity to spread my wings, get us away from our families, and create our own. My future sons would grow up with Minnesota accents and drive their vintage Broncos over frozen lakes, have tater tot hot dishes in the winter, and grow up playing hockey and saying things like kibosh and don't you know. This was going to be our place we built together. 10 days after we moved into our townhome, my husband went off on a business trip for a week in Oklahoma, came home for a week, and then went back to Texas for 31 days. My husband was gone a total of 310 days that year. 310 days out of 365. It was as if he was living a double life. A year after we moved into our townhome, he wanted to buy a house. He thought it would show his startup that he was committed. Odd word coming from him. As we were walking through the home, I looked at the staircase, and I could see bite marks from the dog who lived there before. I envisioned two kids running up and down the stairs and marking the staircase with crayons. Then this knowing came to me, and a voice said, "Your husband is going to have an affair, and you are going to forgive him." I had a knowing long before this voice told me, but I was really good at pushing it aside. A few months later, I found out my husband was having an affair with his distribution rep in Texas. One day, after he had another business trip to Texas, my husband came home and said, "We need to get a divorce." To say I was shocked is a far understatement. My entire world literally spun. Later that night, I would learn his emotional affair had turned physical. As he was confessing to me, he couldn't speak but just nod yes and no to my questions. I was eerily calm. I remember looking at him and saying, "I forgive you and God forgives you." I was committed to working through this and was going to stand by him. Now, not long after we were engaged, I joined the church his family was associated with. I went to church. I said my prayers. I was Christian enough for the both of us. My marriage lasted another 3 or so weeks after that. In those 3 weeks, we had 2 counseling sessions. And of course, my husband had another business trip. 1 minute, he was telling me he loved me and wanted to find his way back to me. Then the next, he's FaceTiming his girlfriend in our basement while she's home with her husband and a 7-year-old son. Amongst all this, in the background, I decided to find resources. The first resource I reached for was The Power of the Praying Wife by Stormy O'Martian. My mother-in-law, a very strong and devout Catholic woman, had recommended this book to me as it had helped her with her marriage. I would walk down to the lake with this book and put my student hat on. I was going to save this marriage, and I was going to be everything this man would ever need, starting with being the perfect Christian wife. As I'm reading this book as though it was an instruction manual, I read a part that changed me. It was the part about praying to God to change your husband, but the change you see won't be in him, it will be in you. I thought, hold the phone. Why do I need to change? I'm not the one committing adultery. I'm the one trying to hold this marriage together. You know what? I did need to change. While I touted my being a good Christian wife, God was nowhere in my home or my marriage. Yeah, I went to church, but I went because I was supposed to. It was obligation. That's why people go to church. I was also married to a man whose heart had become hardened to God, but this man had become my God. I held on to this marriage because I didn't think anyone else would want me. I couldn't breathe without him. Finally, the day came where I knew it was time to end it. It was, to my surprise, a very peaceful moment. In this moment, there was no tension, no fighting. I simply sat on my stairs, called my husband over, knowing that for him to get on the other side of this affair, he had to go through it on his own. I looked at him and said, "I love you enough to let you go." And that was that. I had divorce papers in my backpack, put them on our kitchen table, and went into administrative mode. I handled everything and moved out a week later. The moment I knew it was okay to let go, I felt a hand on my back, like a man leading his lady through a room, but it was leading me out of that house. Labor Day weekend, I packed up my car with everything I could fit, including my dog, and made the drive home to Houston. I looked war-torn, and I felt it too. My company was gracious enough to let me finish my contract fully remote, which in hindsight was the thing that got me out of bed in the morning. I was in a deep depression for 3 months, drinking and smoking myself numb. I couldn't bear to look at myself in the mirror. I felt like trash that had been tossed out to the curb. Every morning I would wake up, reach over for my husband, and then remind myself of my new reality. I would do this every morning for months. When I'd finally get out of bed, I made the short walk across the hall to my workstation, sign in, try not to screw anything up, and take a break every hour for a cigarette and a cry. One morning as I began unpacking, I found this devotional called My Prayer Chair by Carla McDougall. She had personally signed this for me at a marriage retreat we attended. I was so hollow. Something in me knew this book was in my hand for a reason, so I decided to read it. It felt so elementary and basic to me, but that's what I needed. I pictured Carla as she was writing this in a giant brown leather chair, feeling safe, happy, and loved. I wanted that feeling. I needed that feeling. I had made it about halfway through this devotional when one morning I realized the thing that was now getting me out of bed wasn't my work obligation. It was my time in my prayer chair. This was the only time in my day I didn't feel the crushing weight of my emotions or the racing heart rate every time my attorney called. Slowly, the weight I was carrying was getting lighter. Then one day I woke up and I didn't reach for my husband. I didn't feel like I was spinning, and I didn't feel so dark. It was such a spiritual awakening as a physical one. I felt lighter. No, I felt like I wasn't carrying anything at all. In that moment, God was telling me, you don't need to carry this anymore. I will carry this with you. You just need to walk with me. I knew then I was ready to give my life, my heart, and my trust to Jesus Christ. I remember waking up that morning with an image of a sunset and three silhouettes, and silhouettes of three crosses in my mind. I carry that image with me today when I think of that morning, when I truly accepted for the first time that I needed Jesus and was ready to accept that he is God's only son who was crucified for my sins, died on the cross, and was resurrected on the third day. The only thing that brought me back to life and could bring me back to life was Jesus. The only thing that could bring me back to life was him. In Ephesians 2:4, it says, "But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive in Christ, even when we were dead in transgression. It is by grace you have been saved." The next month, I started what would be a 5-year journey with my therapist, who was a licensed minister. She was instrumental in my healing, not only from the affair, but of allowing myself to release my divorce guilt. I kept going back to the Bible and reading every section that referenced divorce from both the Old Testament and the New. I was constantly trying to justify my decision to leave my husband and still feel right with Christ. Over time, the more intimate I became with Christ, the more I learned my justification didn't matter. It happened. I can't undo it. At first, I was angry with God during it all, thinking, why would you bring me this? Why would you let this happen? Why are you letting my marriage fail? He showed me that it was less him permitting it and more him being there with me when I was going through it. I led myself there. That imaginary friend I discovered as a child never left me. I left him. I left him for the world, thinking I was smart enough and strong enough to conquer it on my own. I was going back to him time and time again and making all these promises to him if he would just fix all the things I kept getting wrong. But the moment he took that weight from me was the most sacrificial love I have ever felt. In Matthew 11:28-30, it says, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." There's a pivotal moment in life when the gospel comes alive in you. My favorite verse is Galatians 2:20. "I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by the faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me." It's taken years since this pivotal moment in 2016. Not long after I placed my faith in Jesus, I started reading the Bible, something I never did on my own before. I was always afraid to mark in it or highlight in it because it's a sacred book and it needed to always be in pristine condition, and I thought you needed multiple degrees to understand this book and all the things in it. I figured I would start reading it and maybe one day it would just all make sense to me. January 2017, I met a man. This man was only meant to be me dipping my toe in the dating pool to see if I liked the temperature. My first pancake, the test pancake. I looked at a photo of him. His eyes were kind, his smile was warm, and his body was solid. He seemed like someone who wouldn't intentionally hurt me. I wouldn't say safe. It would be a long time before I would allow myself to feel safe, but kind. And I needed kind. I remember the first time we spoke on the phone, and he was very transparent about being divorced and having a daughter. This did scare me a little bit, having never dated someone with a kid and not having any of my own. There was also something about dating someone who had been divorced. Then he wouldn't be scared to date me, a divorcee. Our first official date was the first time in my life I experienced a man other than my dad pray over a meal on a date. It was that dinner I learned about his desire to disciple men. This guy was such an anomaly for me. Then he kept talking about this guy named Sam, like a lot. I had kept my faith private for the most part. To me, an intimate relationship is one to be kept intimately, not openly. Now I find myself dating a man who actively opens the Bible every morning. I will be very honest. I rolled on the phone a lot of times with how much he talked about Jesus, and I knew it all came from a good place, but it was like my childhood hearing my mom's scriptures all over again. I came to learn after a while together his desire for Jesus, and his example of being in the Word became an example to me. This was a book I had always been intimidated by, like it was calculus. A year or so later, the man who was supposed to be my first pancake married me, taking me as his wife and a bonus mom to his daughter, Daisy. I had finally met Sam, who would be a huge instrument in our early years together. Sam and Jason brought me into this movement, introducing me to some amazing people and bringing back a part of my spiritual nurturing I was yearning for. God brought me a man who believes. God is the cord that keeps our marriage together. I now have a contrast that I didn't have before. In Romans 8:28, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God." And know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. Today, I am thankful for my first marriage. I have healed in Christ, and through him, I hold no ill will, no bitterness, no animosity. My ability to forgive, truly forgive, and still be able to have love for my first husband as a child of God is solely because of Christ in me. In 2022, God had me in a place where I needed to be humbled, and because I was now pursuing him, I was able to listen and walk through the most humbling year of my life. In the early years of Jason's and my marriage, I began to harbor resentment. While we were both divorced, I no longer had communication with my ex and struggled to understand the complexity of my husband's relationship with his. It felt like an intrusion. God had me in a place where he could impress on me that my resentments were going to kill my marriage. I needed to own them, take responsibility for my part, and give them over to Christ before they did any more damage. Our dynamic as a blended family has done a 180, and we are now part of each other's modern family, all because of Christ. I am saved by his grace and mercy and the life he gave for me. There's a song by Elevation Worship that perfectly expresses my love for him and what he did for me. It's called Worthy. The first line makes me cry every time I hear it or sing it. It was my cross you bore, so I could live in the freedom you died for. And now my life is yours. And I will sing of your goodness forevermore. I may not know what's down the road for me, but life is so much easier to enjoy knowing that he has it all under control. I just need to show up and walk beside him. I don't know if this is very traditional, and I'm kind of doing an audible here. But I want to play a song for you guys, if we have time. If I have time. Okay. This is a song that has brought me a lot of comfort. It's one that I mentioned this morning in our small group. And the first time I heard it, it was like my testimony in a song. It's very simple, talking about how easy it is to just talk to Jesus. So I want to share this with you guys. I hope you listen and I hope you enjoy it. And thank you for listening.
Well, he's afraid of love by the letter tonight. He is sounding like mumbling, like she was out of